A federal report reveals gross prosecutorial misconduct in the Ted Stevens investigation and trial. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Presbyterian church officials seek reconciliation with villagers in Gamble.
I really believe they had a huge negative impact because we were humiliated and shamed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
An arrest has been made in the case of kidnapped Anchorage barista Samantha Koenig. Anchorage Police Department spokeswoman Anita Schell says two Anchorage detectives traveled to Lufkin, Texas, and have taken in a person of interest in the case. His name is Israel Keyes, a 34-year-old construction contractor.
We sent two detectives down to Lufkin, Texas to work with their local law enforcement, to include the Texas Rangers and multiple law enforcement agencies in and around Lufkin, as well as the FBI. And on Tuesday, then, arrest was made of Israel Keyes.
Schell says she is not able to release details of what led police to Keyes.
That is part of the open, ongoing investigation. In fact, the arrest warrant was sealed to not compromise the integrity of this case.
Keyes is being held in a federal facility in Beaumont, Texas. Israel Keyes operated a business in Anchorage called Keyes Construction. Schell says there is still no information as to Koenig's whereabouts, although police are hopeful she's still alive because no body has been found. Schell says anyone with information relating to Israel Keyes or who had business dealings with Keyes Construction should contact officials. Kidnapped victim Koenig was abducted on February 1st from the coffee shack where she was working. More than 3 years after the late Senator Ted Stevens was found guilty of omitting gifts on financial disclosure forms, a report made public today says federal prosecutors intentionally withheld information that could have exonerated him, as well as allowing testimony that they knew was false. The report is the work of a special prosecutor appointed by the Washington, D.C. judge who presided over the Stevens trial. The guilty verdict was thrown out in 2009 after allegations of misconduct by the prosecutors, but the new report details the degree to which they hid information and evidence. Libby Casey covered the Stevens trial and its aftermath for APRN and joins us by phone from Washington. Hi, Libby.
Hi, Lori.
Libby, the report is 500 pages. What were you able to get through, and what does it reveal?
Well, it has an executive summary at the beginning, which is fascinating reading, and it's a good place to start digging into it. And it says that both the prosecution and the investigation phase of this case were permeated by systematic concealment of crucial evidence, and that the prosecution let witnesses onto the stand and give false testimony. A lot of this centers around the main witness, Bill Allen. This guy was a friend of Ted Stevens. He ran the oil field services company, Vico, and he liked rubbing elbows with powerful Alaska politicians. Well, prosecutors said he'd given the Stevens couple, Ted Stevens and his wife Catherine, lots of free gifts, including the renovation of their home in Girdwood. Now, prosecutors said that just the home renovations alone were worth about $250,000, but it turns out they had evidence it was worth far less. They never revealed that. And that's significant, especially because the Stevens couple had paid another company for renovations, and they thought the Bill Allen contributions to the project were rolled into their bills. And they paid $160,000 for this renovation project overall. Well, Ted Stevens had written to Bill Allen twice, and this was entered into evidence during the trial. asking for any outstanding bills. And he even referenced another member of Congress who'd broken the law by taking gifts. He said, "Don't forget Torricelli," referring to New Jersey Senator Robert Torricelli, who got busted. He said, "You know, friendship is one thing, but compliance with the ethics rules is entirely different." That didn't have as much weight, though, during the trial for Ted Stevens' defense, because Bill Allen claimed that Stevens was just covering his you-know-what, protecting himself, and didn't really mean it. He didn't really want a bill. Well, it turned out, Lori, that Allen had changed his tune, because at times he'd told prosecutors and FBI agents that the whole covering his you-know-what conversation had never happened. He didn't have any memory of it. So he's changing his perspective on this, and the prosecution goes ahead and enters this in and lets Bill Allen go on the stand and say this, even though they know that he's changed his tune on it. So this investigation says the whole prosecution team, four prosecutors and an FBI agent, had what the investigator calls a sort of group long-term memory fail. They just forgot the conversations ever happened.
Libby, Bill Allen had a history of allegedly lying about legal matters. Prosecutors were aware that he had asked an underage teenage prostitute to lie about having sex with him. They didn't reveal that information to Stevens' attorneys.
Yeah, they claimed that that Allen hadn't pressured her to lie about their sexual relationship. And this is important for a number of reasons. One, it just shows that he was willing to lie about legal matters. It could have been used to impeach Allen on the stand, but it was never turned over to Ted Stevens' lawyers. The biggest thing is it would have painted such a different picture of this man. I mean, imagine how that would have gone over. Lawyers for Ted Stevens asking Bill Allen how he'd strong-armed a teenager into lying about having sex with him. It shows his moral quality, or lack thereof, and it would have completely changed how the jury would have perceived him.
Libby, Bill Allen isn't the only witness that could have backed up Ted Stevens.
That's right, Lori. There was this guy named Rocky Williams who could have been a crucial witness for Ted Stevens. He was sort of like the foreman or the guy who oversaw Vico's role in the renovation project. And he told prosecutors repeatedly that he also thought the Stevens couple had paid all their bills. That would have really changed the perspective of the whole case.
Take us back to 2008. Judge Emmett Sullivan had concerns at the time that prosecutors were holding back information. He expressed a lot of frustration with them about that.
Yeah, now some of this did come out during the trial. Judge Sullivan kept reminding the prosecutors, you have to turn over information, you need to, you know, give this piece of evidence or that thing to the prosecutors. And Judge Sullivan expressed frustration, even anger at times, and came close to throwing out the whole thing, but things kept marching forward because the prosecution would apologize and say they were making good, and then they'd turn over the item in question. What's different now, though, is that this investigation shows intention and willfulness and this sort of group memory loss.
Libby, what happens to the prosecutors who are alleged to have intentionally done this?
Well, basically nothing at this point. Some have been reassigned, and the guy who did this investigation, a guy named Hank Schulke, is not recommending that they be criminally charged. Now, this is a hard one to wrap your mind around because he says they clearly had wrongdoing. But it's not a case of contempt because the judge didn't directly order them to disclose information that they didn't. And he says it has to be by the book. Now, you'd think it'd be their job to follow the law and give information over. And in fact, the judge told them during the case, follow the law. But Schulke says that's just not enough to bring criminal charges against them.
Well, thank you for discussing the report with us today, Libby.
Thanks, Lori.
Libby Casey covered the Ted Stevens trial and its aftermath for APRN. She's now a host and producer of C-SPAN's morning program, Washington Journal. You can find the full investigative report, plus a longer version of this interview on our website, alaskapublic.org. The House today rejected minority amendments to next year's operating budget in anticipation of a final vote on the plan this evening. The changes requested by Democrats pointed to places in the budget that do not prepare the state for future financial instability, which they consider an important goal. Proposed cuts would have reduced or eliminated funding for several individual programs, such as the Alaska Aerospace Development Corporation, Tourism Marketing, and the Alaska Land Mobile Radio System. They would also have increased or restored spending for such programs as a pilot program to demonstrate the value of pre-kindergarten classes in local schools or the Natural Gas Development Authority that voters adopted 10 years ago. Anchorage Democrat Pete Peterson was unsuccessful in protecting school funding from the cost of inflation.
Now, I've had numerous school districts in my office showing me the improvements that they have made in the last few years, including higher graduation rates, lower dropout rates, increased test scores, and more students going on to college. Now is not the time to lose the momentum that many districts have gained by forcing districts all over the state to lay off teachers and cancel programs.
Finance co-chair Bill Stoltz said he's working on a more comprehensive approach to school funding and asked members to hold the issue until he can schedule hearings. And Anchorage Democrat Mike Dugan proposed putting another $2 billion into the body of the permanent fund. He says the state can afford savings right now.
So there's plenty of money on the table. The last time I looked, if we cashed out everything we've got, it's about $19 billion. So in my view, it's time to put a little money really away to help increase the value of the permanent fund for a time when we're actually going to have to go into it and get money.
Bill Thomas, the other finance co-chair, reminded members that the state already faces financial challenges, a potential need for as much as $11 billion to cover state employee and teacher retirement funds, and decreasing revenue from oil production. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a snowboarder who survived the Haines avalanche talks about the accident.
I turned around and just saw it all. Saw a crack go from basically one side to the other, whole opposite side of the mountain.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects on the web at grantstation.com.
The Alaska Supreme Court issued a ruling late yesterday requiring the Alaska Redistricting Board to draw up a new voting district map for the state. An earlier generated map is the subject of a legal challenge by two Fairbanks area voters who claim it disenfranchises them, and the Supreme Court review is the latest step in that case. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Supreme Court has ordered the Alaska Redistricting Board to draw the new map using a process set out in a redistricting case ruling 20 years ago. It puts emphasis on adherence to state constitutional requirements of contiguity, compactness, and socioeconomic integration, with deviations only for federally mandated protection of the Alaska Native vote. Redistricting Board Director Taylor Bickford says the board focused on sorting out complicated rural districts to protect the Native vote, but the court has mandated a different approach.
Essentially what the court has said is, no, you need to draw a plan that ignores federal law, ignores the Federal Voting Rights Act, is not necessarily drawn to protect Alaska Native voting rights. You just need to draw a plan that complies with the Alaska Constitution, and then from there determine if changes need to be made to comply with federal law.
New voter district maps are required to reflect updated census data every 10 years, and there's always legal wrangling over whether they comply with state and federal law. The Supreme Court review includes a few case specifics. It gives merit to the city of Fairbanks having its own Senate district and to two sprawling House districts, one of which taps urban Fairbanks voters to bolster largely rural Native areas. The Fairbanks North Star Borough is an amicus curiae in the case. Assistant Borough Attorney Jill Dolan says the Supreme Court ruling is good for plaintiffs.
It's going to force the board to take a hard look and to actually make findings as to why it's deviating from the Constitution. So with respect to House District 38, which the trial court found to be not socioeconomically integrated, it will require the board to actually take a look at that and justify that.
The Supreme Court ruling sends the case back to Superior Court to be carried out. Dolan says the court has already set up a process and timeline.
Gives parties until April 2nd to submit proposed plans to the board, And then it gives the board till April 13th to file a notice and a request for entry of final judgment with the court. And then there's some other additional deadlines relating to objections and replies. And the court indicates that it expects to issue a decision regarding the new plan by May 15th.
Dolan says the tight timeline appears designed to keep the process on track and produce a finalized voter district map by a June 1st candidate filing deadline. If that doesn't happen, the Supreme Court ruling says the board can petition to use its contested plan for the 2012 election cycle. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Petersburg leaders are encouraged by the Alaska Supreme Court order on the state's new legislative districts. The southeast city was the only other town that had challenged the redistricting board's plan. In that case, the Superior Court ruled in favor of the board last December, and the city chose not to appeal. Petersburg City Manager Steve Giesbrecht says it's prompted local officials to revisit the issue.
We're kind of enthusiastic in the sense that we feel it at least opens the door to give the city council here in Petersburg an opportunity to say, hey, let's take another look at Southeast, and particularly our district.
Petersburg has long shared a Senate district with Sitka, Wrangell, Ketchikan, and some smaller towns. The redistricting board's current plan puts Petersburg together with Juneau and Skagway. Petersburg initially challenged the plan on a number of issues. Last week, national and regional Presbyterian leaders traveled to the village of Gamble for a two-day reconciliation ceremony on St. Lawrence Island, which is located about 165 miles northwest of Nome in the Bering Sea. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Lee Jordan of Chugiak is a church elder and moderator of the Presbytery of the Yukon, which encompasses 23 churches in interior, northern, and northwestern Alaska. He says early missionaries, in what he called a well-intentioned but misguided effort, tried to stamp out the traditional culture of the people of Gamble.
They were told not to speak their native Yupik language, and that the dances that were their tradition were evil and should not be continued. And that has lasted over 100 years and is blamed for a lot of their problems. So they were looking for reconciliation and something to start the process of healing to take care of that situation, make it better.
Lucy Apatiki is a commissioned lay minister in Gamble and village-based counselor. She says the effort to bring about a reconciliation began several years ago when villagers wanted to bring drums and traditional music into the church, but some said it just wasn't done. She says the church's legacy had harmed multiple generations of people.
I really believe they had a huge negative impact because we were humiliated and shame.
Apatiki says she worked with the tribe, City of Gamble, Village Corporation, and clan elders to organize the two-day event. Jordan says that planning paid off. He says the first day they heard talks about multi-generational trauma and its effects. The next day ended with a celebration that drew most of the people of Gamble and many people from Savunga, the other village on St. Lawrence Island.
The gymnasium was just crammed full to overflowing, a standing room only with people there, and they had the program started at 7 o'clock, and it went on with a celebration and dancing, a steady stream of dancing and drumming until midnight.
Apatiki says elders described their grievances, then church elders asked for forgiveness and offered each clan leader a plaque with a written apology. She says she saw a changed attitude at the celebration.
It was a powerful, powerful celebration. There was a freedom in the dance and the song. And in my entire life, I had never seen so many of our men dancing with such abandonment and freedom. It was powerful.
Apatiki says she hopes people will accept the church's apology as an opportunity for forgiveness and self-healing.
We're hoping that it will have some positive impact in our schools, in our high level of alcoholism and, the domestic violence. We're highest in the nation for all those things that we're struggling with, not just here in Gamble, but throughout the other villages in our region and throughout the state of Alaska.
The event also included presentations by Father Michael Oleksa, an expert on cross-cultural effects of early Christianity in Alaska, and Dorothy Bozak, a historical trauma therapist. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A draft of a health impact assessment of a proposed coal mine related to several communities in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough has been released by the state. A state mining permit is still pending for Usabelli Coal's project at Wishbone Hill. Although approval of the permit does not hinge on the health report, stakeholders in the mine decision are weighing it carefully. The 140-page document was posted on the State Department of Health and Social Services website this week. Dr. Paul Anderson, HIA Program Manager for the State Division of Epidemiology, says an HIA actually outlines a set of procedures used to evaluate public policy.
Or in the case that we have here in Alaska, large resource development projects, and it attempts to look at the potential human health impacts for populations and the distribution of those effects within the population.
Anderson says the HIA program represents a collaboration among state agencies, public health officials, and tribal groups. The HIA is open to public comment through April 30th. A snowboarder who survived the massive avalanche that killed two people near Haines this week is speaking out about the incident. Brandon Corbett was in a group of heli skiers and snowboarders on a mountain about 20 miles from Haines Tuesday morning when the accident happened. The avalanche killed 26-year-old Nikolai Dodov and a guide, 35-year-old Rob Lieberman. From Member Station KHNS, Tara Bicknell reports.
Both men were recovered by fellow skiers and snowboarders using avalanche beacons. Among them was client Brandon Corbett.
That probably helped us a little bit, but it was just the amount of time it took. You know, it was just too hard to hike straight uphill in snow, and we were the only ones in the position to be able to get there. So it took a long time. It took too much time.
34-year-old Corbett lost two friends in the accident. He was on the same run as Nick and Rob and had just snowboarded down the mountain to a safe spot when the avalanche broke.
I was the first one down. I stopped on a high point, and two other riders followed me my path down and stopped behind me. And then when I turned around and looked up, I heard that our fourth rider was dropping in, and I didn't know if it was Nick or if it was one of the other guys. And I turned around and just saw a crack go from basically one side to the whole opposite side of the mountain, and it was just like a river flowing down at that point.
Skiers later described a 6-foot-deep crown separating the huge slab of snow from the mountain. Both Nick and Rob were buried at least 7 feet under the debris. After locating and recovering them, rescuers immediately performed CPR and transported the two victims to the Haines Clinic, 33 road miles away, by helicopter and by ambulance.
You know, right when I really got a probe strike, we found somebody was when the helicopter landed with a lot of guides, and there was probably, I don't know how many people they were digging at that point, but it took a long time. They were deep.
The group of six included four childhood friends who grew up snowboarding in the mountains around California's Lake Tahoe area. Corbett has heli-skied before, including an earlier trip to Haines 3 winters ago. It was Dodov's first heli-ski trip.
He was just, you know, guy had incredible energy, incredible smile. He was really positive, and, you know, he loved the mountains. He loved snowboarding, and you know, the day before, we had all pretty much had the day of our lives.
Lieberman, who was guiding for Alaska heli-skiing, was from Telluride, Colorado. He wrote in his company profile that skiing has been a deep-rooted love since early childhood and that Alaska has always been the Mecca after his first trip to the state in 2005.
Rob was one of the big reasons why we came back here. Because he's just an incredible guide, just real positive, really knowledgeable, and just the reason why we wanted to come back here.
Guides for the company, as noted on their website, are professionally trained and certified and qualify as guides under the requirements set by the Alaska Helicopter Skiing Association. Alaska Heliskiing surveyed the scene of the accident and released a statement late Wednesday saying, quote, "While this type of event is an inherent risk of big mountain helicopter-assisted skiing, Alaska Heliskiing has offered its sincere condolences to the families of its deceased guide and client," end quote. The company says the emergency rescue processes in the incident followed normal response procedures. The company requires each of their clients to take a formal helicopter safety briefing and attend backcountry safety school. Reporting in Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
The 67th running of the Open North American Championships get underway in Fairbanks this weekend. Sled dog teams run a total of 70 miles over 3 days in what's been called the fastest and longest running race of its kind. KWC's Emily Schwing has this preview.
The Alaska Dog Mushers Association has hosted the Open North American Sled Dog Championship every year since 1946.
The Open North American race is known for its speed.
That's ADMA President Shannon Earhart. For her, the race is a family affair that started with her father back in the 1960s.
Oh yeah, my dad Garrett is Gareth Wright, and he's ran it since he was 18, and he's won it twice. And my sister is Roxy Wright, and she's won it many times herself. So.
And what about you?
I've ran it once, and my husband has ran it a few times, and I hope to run it again. Two of my oldest children have competed in the race, so it's still... still going. My brother-in-law is planning on racing this weekend, so quite the family tradition for us.
The Open North American is the oldest continuously running sled dog race of its kind.
Never missed a year. We might have had to change start venues, but it's never missed a race due to weather conditions or too warm of weather. We've always kept it going. And I think just because of the community nature that it is the premier race that it is, it has a history that everybody talks about.
Race rules allow for an unlimited number of dogs on each team, but mushers must drive at least 5. Teams are racing for a total purse of $25,000. The money will be split amongst the top 15 finishers. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Dan Barras and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Tara Bicknell in Haines. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.